There's a lot to keep new parents awake at night. But it won't be the prices at Asda's baby and toddler event, starting from the 21st of April, including the MAM anti-colic bottle set down from £38 to £24.98 and the Newbie Rapid Cool bottle maker down from £40 to £24.88. Plus, for more exclusive offers, sign up to Asda Rewards Baby and Toddler Club. That's Asda price. Select a source and line subject to availability. Asda Reward requires app and registration. One membership per person. Full T's and C's. Asda.com/rewards/terms.
Hello and welcome to Immigrantly. I'm your host, Nadia Khan. Did you know I speak 5 languages, but sometimes I feel I am not truly good at any. Some are more advanced than others. English is what I use for intellectual conversations, but Urdu is my language of familiarity, of everyday rhythm. And Pashto, my mother tongue, is what I think in. It's where my emotions live. But in my daily life, and I've said this before, I mix them up. I switch between languages constantly, sometimes in the same sentence. Unless someone only knows one language, I rarely speak just one. It's like a tossed salad of expression. And in that mix, I often wonder, am I fluent in any of them? Have I sacrificed mastery for flexibility? But maybe that's the wrong question. Maybe the point isn't to be perfect in a language, but to live in it, bend it, claim it, belong to it. My guest today thinks just that. Angela Lin is the founder of Real You Mandarin, a language learning platform and really a philosophy that centers cultural connection over grammatical perfection. She's Taiwanese-American, a polyglot, and someone who believes that how we feel in a language matters just as much as how we speak it. Preach, sister, preach. Angela is here to help us rethink not just how we learn languages, but why we learn them in the first place. So without further ado, let's get started. Hello, how are you doing?
Hi, I'm doing great. How are you?
I am good. Angela, where are you based right now?
Currently, I'm in Orange County, California, but actually in the fall, I'm moving to Japan permanently.
Oh my gosh. You know, Japan is on my to-do list. I really want to go visit. Just to give everybody context, I am shit scared of flying. So the fact that I want to go fly to Japan is a huge deal. I've heard so many good things. Oh my gosh. My husband went there twice and he was like, it's an incredible place.
Well, I highly recommend it. Let me know if you end up going.
So why did you decide to move to Japan?
Yeah. So my husband and I have been digital nomads for the last like 3 years or so. So we spent maybe a year and a half in total in Japan during that time. And we also lived in Korea and Taiwan. My family's from Taiwan. So kind of split across those three countries. But we just really fell in love with it. My husband has been in love with Japan forever already. He's not Japanese. He's from Spain. It's a whole amalgamation of different things. But yeah, we loved it so much. It's just such a nice way of life there. And things work really well. And quality of life is higher than you can find a lot of times elsewhere. So yeah, we're taking the plunge.
But it's a very homogenous society, right? In terms of the demographic.
It is.
having grown up in the US, how do you reconcile with that?
It's been really interesting being an Asian appearing person in Asia, but not of the country that I'm in. I think I had a bit of an identity crisis in the beginning, especially because, and we're going to talk a lot about this today, but language, right? When you don't have the language to communicate with the majority of the people around you, it is quite difficult because you start feeling like you lose a part of yourself. Like if you can't express your opinions, your values, even just general, you know, everyday things, it starts chipping away at you a little bit. So in the beginning, I actually did not love Japan because of that. It had nothing to do with Japan. It had a lot to do with myself of being kind of like insecure about not being able to express myself. But I think, yes, the homogenous part will never go away. There is always this kind of strange interaction when I have with like the first time with any Japanese person because I don't look Japanese, but there are a lot of Asian immigrants in Japan. Doesn't make up, you know, the majority of the percentage of the population or anything, but there are plenty of Asians that are either students or they work in like different parts of, especially like hospitality. I think they look for a lot of people who can speak different languages for hotels and restaurants and stuff like that. So when they see an Asian face, they assume you can speak Japanese. They don't assume you are Japanese, but they assume you can speak Japanese. So we actually had a really funny like transition period because my husband and I are both learning Japanese and we're about like higher intermediate is where I'd put us at this moment. But when I first started, I had nothing. I had like, I knew 10 words and he was like above beginner. So it was really weird because we'd go out to a restaurant and then the waiter would automatically look at me and start speaking, you know, this monologue in Japanese and be like, I have no idea. And I direct them to my Spanish husband and they're like, what?
How difficult is it to learn Japanese?
A bit of a complicated question. I think of all the Asian languages, Japanese is actually not one of the hardest. And I am coming from the perspective of I already speak Mandarin. So Chinese is notoriously very difficult to learn because there's many tones and pronunciations just like very hard. And Japanese is interesting because there's a part of their whole language that borrows from Chinese. So all the characters that are like traditional come from China. I have this weird mix where I oftentimes can know what something means, but I don't know how to say it because the pronunciation's different. For me, I had a leg up. That's why I think my husband's a little bit jealous of how far I've progressed once I did commit to learning because he's like, what? You're cheating because you already know.
Yeah. That is cheating. Yeah, oh, he's right, Angela. He's absolutely right. Talking about languages, oh my gosh, I have so many questions, thoughts. I speak 5 languages. I said this in my intro. I have reserved English for intellectual conversations. And then Urdu is my like rhythm of life. Urdu is what I vibe with. And Pashto is my mother tongue. That's what I live in. And you talked about how languages are not as much about communication as they are about belonging. So talk to me a little bit more about how you see your relationship with different languages that you speak.
First, I guess I'll lay out the languages and also my connection to them. So English, of course, I was born and raised in the U.S., Mandarin is my second most fluent language because my family is from Taiwan, so I grew up speaking it at home. Then it would be Spanish. So I am committed to continuing my Spanish because my husband is from Spain. His whole family only speaks Spanish, but I actually already had learned Spanish a long time ago because I grew up in California. Many of us kind of forcibly chose that as our second language. And then now Japanese, which is kind of intermediate. So these are my 4. Belonging is very important. I do think that's a big piece of it. But for me, I think of it more about expression, like self-expression, your ability to do so. And I talked a little bit already about your personality being able to come through or not. I think, you know, So I have this business now called Ryu Mandarin. It's all about enabling and empowering Mandarin speakers who probably were born and raised outside of Asia to be able to express their full selves in Mandarin. And the reason I really felt compelled to even create this was because of my own relationship with all these different languages. So I had a lot of aha moments when I had a loss for words in all of these languages at different points. So the first one was really Spanish. So my husband, as I mentioned, his family only speaks Spanish. I think I came in with a lot of overconfidence. I was like, oh, I've been speaking Spanish my whole life. It was my minor in college. No. When you're trying to have real conversations with people, and also I think there's you don't know what dynamics you're not set up for until you're in them. So I think for me, it was like the first family dinner, right? You're sitting around the table, there's five of us, and everyone's speaking at the same time. It's really hard when you are not like perfectly fluent in the language to, first of all, keep up, and then to interject the conversation in time to stay with that conversation.
Oh my God, I would be shit scared. Like, interjecting is not happening. It's not happening.
Oh no. I was silent, honestly, for the first like period of my relationship with him and his family. And I remember thinking, I got so frustrated because I was like, I don't think your parents even know my personality because they think I'm just really quiet. And they don't know I'm actually quite loud and I have like a lot of opinions, but I don't have this ability to interject myself this way. And so I think a part of it is actually having the words to say what you want to say. And the other part is confidence, because at this point I've come to terms with Spanish of like, I'm at the level I'm at. And I'm just going to butcher, you know, conjugations. I'm going to talk in present tense only. I'm going to sound like a caveman, but I'm going to let my personality come through because I'm done and I'm sitting in the background. So, yeah, that was that.
Angela, you'd mentioned your language learning platform, RealU Mandarin, which teaches Mandarin to people who've lived outside their motherland. First, let me take a step back and talk about the philosophy behind the Ryu Mandarin. The language learning is supposed to be more conversational, right? More colloquial than anything else. How difficult is it to teach somebody conversational language than to teach them the basics and then move on? How is it different?
Ryu Mandarin is, I'd say, completely different from your standard textbook, you know, language course. And I'll just be upfront, I'm not a language teacher. I was compelled to create this because, honestly, I wanted something like this and it's not out there. So I was like, I need to figure out how to make this myself. So I enlisted Mandarin teachers in Taiwan and I'm currently recruiting. So if you're a Mandarin teacher, hit me up. I collaborate really closely with these teachers to create the content that would give us the words that we're missing. So it is interesting when you talk about the idea of fluency. So I think a lot of us who were born and raised outside of the motherland, who learned the mother tongue, we often say we're fluent because we have this weird sense of fluency where a lot of us actually have, you know, perfect pronunciation. Like when I go back to Taiwan, people don't know necessarily I'm from the US because of my pronunciation. They know something's off because I dress differently. I'm tan, which is not a big thing in Asia. But just from speaking alone, they don't necessarily know until I mess up on something really basic. So there are all these things where it's like everyday societal things that you would not be aware of if you don't live there. And then there's the deeper stuff, which is really what we teach through the conversational format. So you're never going to learn 100% of everything you want to know until you're put in that situation. But what we're trying to do, what our philosophy really is help kickstart you in the right direction on topics you're probably already wanting to have. So for example, one of our modules of our existing course is about mental health. And there's a lot of stigma in many Asian societies and cultures around mental health. And I, for what, I based the script off a real conversation I had with my mom, where I was telling her about how I've been gaining a lot from going to therapy. And she was like, I truly don't understand why you need to go see a therapist. Like, you're not crazy, you know? So it's navigating through that very realistic conversation that probably many of us have had to have. So what I like about our philosophy is really it's, you know, you can pick and choose. Like, of course, we have a sequence, but you can just jump to the topic that you actually want to talk about and start learning, get at least, you know, the starting basis of the real words that you've been missing so that you feel more confident approaching these types of topics instead of just shying away. I think a lot of us shy away from wanting to have these topics or talk about these topics with like family, friends, people in the motherland because we just don't feel equipped for it.
This is so fascinating to me. You talked about what people gain through your philosophy. What gets lost, though?
What gets lost? Well, I wouldn't say things get lost. I think that if you go into it hoping you're going to learn everything you've missed, that's too lofty of a goal. Because similar to what I said about, you know, you don't know what dynamics you're not prepared for until you're put in that situation. I can't come up with a script for every conversation you're going to have in your life, right? So I think it's about expectations. Like, we are trying to give you I'd call it like a starter kit for many of these big topics. But ultimately, you won't know what you want to express either until you try. So hopefully this will give you also a better sense of what deeper level words you're missing, and then you can kind of continue that search yourself. But right now, I think so many of us even miss just the most basic level things.
Because people are scared, right? If they don't know a language, if they're not fluent in a language, they are scared to speak it. Now, when you hear someone say, I speak Mandarin, but not well, what does that bring up for you? Like, is that self-doubt something you've had to unlearn yourself? I assume English is your first language, not Mandarin, right?
Yeah, well, funny thing about that, I actually just talked about this with someone recently. I think actually Mandarin might have been my first language because, you know, before you go into the school system, you're just with your parents. So my mom only speaks Mandarin at home. And we had these cute little audio tapes of when we were kids. And I found this one many years ago where my mom is teaching me the alphabet. And I pronounced it very not like American accent because I was just imitating her. So I think my first language is probably Mandarin. But, you know, as soon as you enter preschool, even then English is introduced and it's your entire environment. So yeah, very quickly overtaken by English. So back to your actual question, when someone says they speak Mandarin, but not well, I think it's complicated. I think language is so unique to every single person's experience. So that's definitely something that I've also had to come to terms with in building this platform. So that's another expectation, I guess, is where your own level is at. I think people really need to come to terms with it themselves. So my platform is really for people more like me, which does make up a large base of people, which is, you know, you can speak the language, your pronunciation is pretty good, but your missing vocabulary is largely the context. However, there are many people who don't really speak the language that well. And in that terms, they need to go back to basics. Because if you can't even distinguish between the four tones in Mandarin, like, that's really difficult to start having these deep conversations if you're not even pronouncing, you know, the basic words correctly. So it really depends on the person. But for me, as someone who can speak relatively well, but I still kind of say I don't speak it well, yes, there's definitely a self-doubt aspect. I think there's also a cultural aspect. So for many of us who do speak the language, but we feel inept in many ways, I think there's a bit of shame involved with not being able to speak truly fluently, like as fluently as someone in the motherland. And I think there is this weird dynamic where part of it is truly a bit of shame that we are receiving from, you know, those in the motherland who are disappointed that we cannot speak as fluently as them. They might see us as like a little less than in a way, because you're either fully American and you don't know the language, or, you know, you're butchering the tones and they're just like, okay, write you off as an American. Or there's an expectation that you are perfectly fluent. So when you have these kind of basic things that you just don't get, they're kind of like, are you stupid?
But that's being judgmental though, right? I wonder what you think of perfectionism in language learning. Do you think we lose when we focus too much on correctness rather than connection?
Yes. Yes, absolutely. And this goes back to my connection to many different languages, right? So right now I'm in the midst of trying to improve my Japanese. I start from zero, so I really know that trajectory of knowing nothing to being able to express something. And I had this exact debate with my husband, where he was better than me at a certain point, right, in the beginning. And he would get frustrated with himself when he couldn't express exactly the way he wanted to. And I was like, you know what? At some point, I think vocabulary is more important than grammar. And like being able to just like shout out like beer, you know, shrimp or whatever, at least they know what you want, as opposed to fumbling over, oh, I didn't exactly formulate the sentence perfectly. And of course, that progresses, right? So now we're well past the shouting random menu items point of our language speaking. But I know when I'm speaking honestly and I'm saying it wrong. But as long as the person can understand me and they can connect with me, they understand generally what I'm trying to convey, I think that's much more important than being afraid to say it at all because you're trying to construct this perfect sentence.
What is the internal dialogue that's happening when you know that your language or the way you pronounce your delivery is not perfect? What are you thinking?
I mean, I think, honestly, this is goes into a lot of self-work as well, right? It's like how much you care about what other people think. And it's a big one for me. I am still overcoming it. It's definitely one of the things I've cared about the most in my life. It's like, what do other people think? And for me, unfortunately, I think I still care. And so it kind of depends on the receptivity of the person I'm speaking to. So I think a lot of people, especially in Japan, right? So I'm talking about Japanese in this instance, they're pretty patient with people who are trying to speak Japanese. Also because you mentioned it's a homogenous society, right? So they understand they don't speak English. And so it's like, oh, it's kind of, you know, honorable that you're trying to learn our language as somebody who doesn't need to really learn our language. So I think there's a lot of patience on many people's ends. But I have come across others who kind of, you know, poke fun. And so it kind of depends. If I feel that connection of good faith that like they're trying to understand and they're kind of encouraging me like, yeah, go on, go on. I feel confident. And I'm like, yeah, I'm just going to roll with it. Even if initially, there's always that like, oh no, you know, this dread of like, they're going to laugh at me or they're going to think less of me. I think it depends on the person that you're connecting with. And I hope to ultimately get to the point where I don't care what other people think and I can just roll with it, no matter who I'm speaking to. But yeah, I do think, you know, connection takes two or more people. So it does depend on the energy of the other person as well.
Angela, in your own life, do different languages bring out different versions of you? Because you speak four languages, right? Like, is there a language you feel braver in or more playful or softer or more emotional?
Yes, it's actually quite funny. I think in many Asian languages, but I'll say Japanese especially because that's the one I'm learning right now. But a lot of Asian languages, you switch to a softer way of speaking I think there's many things layered into that. So one is like societally how people act in that culture. So in Japan, yeah, it's a very orderly, you know, society. People, especially the people towards people you don't know, it's very respectful and kind of softer. And then even in Mandarin, there's a bigger personality a lot of times with people speaking Chinese than people speaking Japanese. But there's also in many Asian cultures, this idea of like respect, different levels of respect that you give people, especially to the elderly, people older than you in general. I will never forget in college. So I was doing a group project with somebody and they were Taiwanese, like from Taiwan. And we had only ever spoken in English because, you know, I went to NYU. I know you're in New York. So yeah, we were in New York. And so, you know, everyone's speaking English. So they had never heard me speak Mandarin. And then my friend's mom called me suddenly and she never calls me. So I was like, oh, I should pick up. I don't know what this is. So I was speaking in Mandarin and my voice immediately changed to be like higher and softer. Someone's mom. So I got to be respectful. Then I hung up. And that classmate was like, I have never heard you speak Mandarin and you're a totally different person. So yes, I think there's like four different Angelas depending on the language.
What language brings out most emotions in you?
Oh boy. I think the one that has the widest range of emotions is still English because it's my heart language because it's where I grew up. So this is the one where I feel like I can be 100% myself. I will say I have this very weird dynamic with Chinese because for better or for worse, a lot of Chinese culture, families don't really know how to communicate that well, especially big emotions. So there was a lot of like yelling in our family growing up. And it doesn't even need to be when you're actually angry. It could just be a playful kind of like, hey, you know.
But why do you think yelling is not an emotion?
Oh, I associate it more with anger or frustration, like a more traditional emotion, I guess. But yes, yelling can be separate from anger.
The reason why I say this is because in Pashto, which I call my mother tongue, when I speak to my sister in Pashto, people who are listening and do not understand the language, they think we are fighting. We're just loud and we are expressive. Most emotive that I can be, I am in that language. But for an onlooker, somebody who's listening, they're like, oh my gosh, are you guys fighting? Is there something wrong? Like my husband doesn't understand the language. And he's like, why are you fighting with your mom or your sister? And I'm like, no, we are just talking.
Yes. Now that you say it like that, I do think Chinese is like that. Because my husband has said the exact same. He says it every time. He's like, are you in a fight right now with your mom? I'm like, no, we're just talking.
We're just talking, like, right?
Yeah. And the more I tuned into when he said that, I would watch like TV shows or just like, you know, when I'm at the airport and it's a Taiwanese, you know, group of people. I started realizing that. I was like, oh, it is quite loud. Like the volume is quite loud and it is quite expressive. But there's an endearing aspect to it too, where it's like, oh, this feels familiar. And oh, this, yeah, that's just Taiwanese people. So yeah, I agree. There is a big difference. And yeah, yelling, maybe it's not yelling. It's just, you know, a louder.
More expressive, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, when I think of languages, I often feel like I live in translation. Even when I'm not technically translating anything, I think in one language, I speak another language, I sleep in a third language altogether. Do you ever feel this tension between all these different languages that you know?
I will say for me, it's mostly when I'm interacting with people in multiple languages, and less so, like, it's very interesting to me that you dream in a different language and think in a different language. I think for me, it's still English most of the time. But I do think cultural aspects have a big play into which language you might default to in a specific situation. So I think in a different episode, I was listening to interview the host of the In-Between-ish podcast. Yeah. And you were talking about this language aspect as well and thinking and speaking or visualizing in different things. For me, the cultural aspect, so for example, like you can't translate everything, right? Like even if you pull up the dictionary, it doesn't tell you, if you don't understand the societal reason this word exists, right? Like it's very hard to convey. So in that respect, sometimes actually while I've been in the US here, I do sometimes randomly say a word or two in Japanese because I'm just like, oh, that's just, it fits.
I do mix up languages like in one sentence. If people knew the languages that I was speaking, I would mix them up. One sentence would have like at least two languages, Urdu and English, definitely combined.
Well, so on that same note, I think what's also interesting about Real You Mandarin is that a whole maybe like third of the course is focused on exploring this cultural difference. So like where East and West meet. So there is this big aspect of expressing yourself based on your experiences. And I think when we talk about language, right, that shame I was talking about, like sometimes we get judgments from people in the motherland, like, why aren't you more fluent? And a phrase I often hear from native people about getting better in Chinese is, oh, just watch TV shows and movies, like it's so easy. Why won't you just do that? You know, they prescribe it as this one-off thing. And I agree, you can really expedite your, especially modern society, you know, colloquial way of speaking, if you absorb just a ton of content. But ultimately, you're learning how to speak like a native of that country, right? And we're not from there. So my experience as an Asian American is completely different from someone who grew up in Taiwan. So I have a module, for example, on media representation or being a minority in a majority society. And even though I collaborated on this course with a very, you know, I'd call her pretty worldly, like Taiwan-based Mandarin tutor, she lived in Europe and Australia and the US in different points in her life, we had to go back and forth a lot on the actual course content because the way she would translate things, I was like, that's not what that means. She was like, what is a token Asian? I don't know what that means. Because they'd never come across that kind of experience.
Oh, the vernacular. It's different.
Yes.
It's based on experiences, right?
Exactly.
Ah, I did not even think of that. And I wonder how my kids reconcile with that, having grown here versus Urdu that I speak or Urdu that my husband speaks, because we grew up in Pakistan. So our interaction with language is pretty much rooted in our experiences there. That's such an interesting point. Angela, what does it mean to be fluent to you now? Has the definition changed?
Yes, I think so. I no longer have aspirations of being able to know every single word in the dictionary and count that as fluent. I think that was my original way. Or no, my original way was being exactly as good at this language as someone in the motherland. That was always what I counted as fluent. And so it felt like this really lofty goal. And I no longer really feel like that's the goal for me. And I've said it now many times, but expression, self-expression is the most important thing to me. So as long as I feel enabled to express my real self in language, I think that's sufficient. So if I don't know every single word, that's fine. But as long as I can convey my personality, that someone really feels like they know who I am in that language, then I feel like I'm fluent. You reach a weird roadblock stage in every language development where you're kind of getting maybe like 70% across, but then you have still too much that you don't know. I think many people have to get past that hump. And right now I'm at that hump in Japanese. I'm at the, like, I'd call it like the 80%, 90% mark for Mandarin. You know, like, people definitely can feel my personality, but I still have to throw in a lot of English. And yeah, I want to get past that stage where it feels more like, you know, a fluid conversation.
So what's the measure of fluid conversation? Is it a conversation that really helps or elevates your personality in some ways?
It's where you are able to express your opinions and your values, even if you don't know the words.
Give me an example.
I had a really great Spanish teacher who always encouraged me to never break from Spanish when we were talking. And we would always talk about real things. We talked about very deep things, like, we don't even have to talk about this, it's so deep, but we talked about my ayahuasca trip in Peru. Like, we talked about real conversations. And he was like, don't use English. Use Spanish and use the most basic words. Use the words you know to describe what you mean. And we'll continue from there. And I think that's a really great goal. Like, you will probably never know every single vocabulary word that you want to know until you come across it and then you'll learn it. But if you feel, when I talk about fluid, like, if you feel confident enough in expressing yourself in that language, even if you have to describe what you mean using other words, but words that, you know, can help the person understand, and then they'll fill in the blank for you. I think for many of us who grew up here, we speak Chinglish. So I don't know if there's a parallel word for you guys.
There is.
Yeah. So Chinese plus English. And I think there's an endearing aspect to it where it is part of our culture, you know, the mixing of the languages. But if we're being honest with ourselves, I think a lot of us use Chinglish in a way that is mostly because we don't have that word in Chinese. So we just fill in the blank automatically with English. And especially with our parents, like, many of them, sure, they still don't understand a lot of the same concepts. There's generational things as well, but they've lived here now for decades. So they generally can understand and we get away with it. But when you try to talk to people in the motherland, it doesn't have to be strangers. Many of us have extended family. Like, all of my adult cousins are in Taiwan. And I want to connect with them. And I think we hit a lot of roadblocks because if you try to speak Chinglish to them, they truly can't connect because they don't have that English aspect.
It's so interesting to me because in Pakistan, that exists. Pakistan has two official languages, English and Urdu. So I grew up speaking English and Urdu mixed. And that's something that we brought here as well. So when my kids talk to their cousins in Pakistan, they are able to code switch. In fact, it's the other way around. My kids are unable to mix English and Urdu. So for them, it's difficult to latch on to what their cousins are saying in Pakistan, which is very different from what you're saying. It's the other way around for you guys, right?
Yes. Well, you have to have a matched level of understanding in both languages, right, to be able to do that. So because, yeah, ours is a cheat code. It's not actually because we're purposefully using that English word. But for my cousins, you know, English is the dominant language in the world. So most countries feel like they need to teach their people English, even if it's not their main language, but to varying degrees. So I think a lot of Asian countries, everyone, quote, knows English, but not really. Like, all my cousins grew up learning English in school, but they are not confident at all speaking it. And they would not be able to do, you know, this code switching or mixing of the languages. So in that respect, this, like, fluidity I was talking about, right? It's kind of tough when I feel like I'm vibing with my cousin, you know, we're having fun talking about something. And suddenly I come across a word and it's really pivotal to whatever story I'm telling or the experience. And we just hit this weird gap. And the conversation stops. And it's like, oh, I wish I knew how to say that, or I wish you knew that English word. So I think I'm trying to help people get past that. Because it kind of sucks when you're flowing and you're vibing and then it just suddenly is like,
Yeah. In any language, that's a bummer, right? Even if you were speaking a language fluently, and if it happens, it's like, oh gosh, what's that word? What is that word? That one word that's, you know, messing it all up. a lot of people who speak only one language can't relate to, right? Because the beauty, the depth, the sense of belonging, code switching that comes from multiple languages is such a phenomenal experience to have. Angela, in the end, if you were to define the United States of America in the context of languages or lack thereof, how would you do that?
Defining the U.S. in terms of language. You know what? It's so hard to define because, you know, even if you remove language and you just try to define the U.S., it's so hard, right? We're so many different. We're people of the whole world who come together. And yet we've created something new in this space. So even with language, it is interesting to try to define that because I think we've come up with our own languages within each community too. So we've talked about this, you know, you also switch between or mix the two languages. Every Asian language, I think, has the version of Chinglish, which is like Konglish for Korean. You know, everyone has that little phrase. And it's because it's a unique thing from having lived in this Western area, you don't end up speaking just that language. So I think the U.S. is, you know, it's a cliche, but when we talk about the melting pot, it's because it really is that. You're mixing not only like your original native mother culture and language, you're mixing it with English, of course, is the predominant language, but you're also mixing it with like so many different cultures that are around you. So like I'm in Southern California right now. I grew up here actually. And one of my favorite things is connecting with the Mexican community because it's so deep here, right? And so the Spanish and the foods even, the mixing of food is another big element of the human aspects, right? Like language is big, but like people can commune over food, even if you don't speak the same language. And I think that's something really beautiful about the U.S. is this mixing of cultures and creating something new. So it's hard for me to define U.S. in terms of language, but it's something new.
Something new, right. I like that. Something new. I will take that. Angela, where can people find information about your courses? And is there a website they can go to?
Yes, you can find out more at realyoumandarin.com. The U is Y-O-U. And it's the same for all of our social media. So Instagram, TikTok, YouTube, it's all realyoumandarin. And for those who are Mandarin speakers and interested in potentially joining one of our courses or other offerings, we have a free preview lesson of the course. So if you just go to the website, it's very big and bold there, free preview lesson. I also have a podcast that I started recently that's Mandarin language. So Really Mandarin, the podcast. And every episode, I have a native speaking guest and we try to engage in these real conversations. And every time I stumble upon a word, they fill in the blanks with the appropriate Chinese vocabulary. So again, you learn in context. And that way we're trying to enable these, you know, adults, grown up, real conversations and giving you the words that you're probably missing. Also, if you are interested in joining us in the course, I would love to give your listeners a discount. So yeah.
Oh,
yeah,
we
love a discount. So you can get 10% off any of our offerings using Immigrantly10.
We'll post it on our socials. This is so exciting. I love it. Thank you, Angela. Thank you for this. It was a pleasure to have you on Immigrantly.
I had so much fun. Thank you so much, Sadia.
What a fun conversation. I am obsessed with learning more languages, knowing about languages, interrogating how languages impact people, how they work within our brains, how we code switch, how they inform our personalities, how they influence our thought processes. There's so much around languages that's fun and interesting. And if you speak more than one language, And if you liked this conversation, or even if you speak one language and you enjoyed this conversation, do share it with a friend, a family member, somebody who will benefit. Also, if you are interested in learning Mandarin, check out Angela's platform, Real You Mandarin, and get 10% discount for all Immigrantly listeners. This episode was produced by me, Sadia Khan, written by me. The editorial review is done by Shay Yu. Our editor and sound designer is Lou Raskin. Theme music is done by Simon Hutchinson. Other music by Epidemic Sound. Come back next week for another conversation. And take care.